It's Wednesday, December 7th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a closer look at the implication of fake news. We've got three pretty disturbing cases, including one where the police purposely misled reporters. A CNN field producer who should have known better, because we all know every mic is an open mic. We'll talk about what was caught on tape. And President Barack Obama's post-White House plans, rumor has it he might be looking to join our ranks, running a media startup. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well before the half hour's up, but let's start with the deadly warehouse fire in Oakland. Investigators are closer to finding out what caused the massive fire, which killed 36 people in the overnight hours Friday into Saturday. While not zoned for residential use, there were a couple of dozen people who called the ghost ship home. Yesterday morning, the leaseholder appeared for a live interview on the Today Show. Here's the tail end of that.
So for the families, can you...
I'm only here to say one thing, that I am incredibly sorry, and that everything that I did was to make this a stronger, more beautiful community, and to bring people together. People didn't walk through those doors because it was a horrible place. People didn't seek us out to perform and express themselves because it was a horrible place.
Nobody
I'm 47 years old. I'm the father of this space.
Mr. Almond, and no one is saying it was a horrible
place, but
people are...
On the night of the fire, did I know there was going to be a fire? Did I remove my children from the space and get a hotel? Because I wanted to avoid this, because I wanted to cast blame on other people? No, because I wanted to get a good night's sleep with my children.
Mr. Almond, I wanted
to let the young people do what they needed to do. I'm not going to answer these questions the way that you're presenting them.
Mr. Almond, obviously,
I didn't do anything ever in my life that would lead me up to this moment.
Can I ask you if
you are... I'm an honorable man. I'm a proud man. No, I'm not going to answer these questions on this
level. Are you worried that you
will
be charged?
I'd rather get on the floor and be trampled by the parents. I'd rather let them tear at my flesh than answer these ridiculous questions.
Mr. Almond,
I'm so sorry. I'm incredibly sorry. What do you want me to say? I'm not going to answer these questions.
Then we will call this...
I'm just going to say that I am sorry.
Then we'll end the interview there, Mr.
Almond. If you have to hold my soul accountable for believing in something...
Well, we appreciate your time this morning.
And other artists and other beautiful people that also believed with me. And for 3 years,
we will continue to follow this story and its developments.
It was a difficult interview to watch, in part because of that obvious anguish that Almond is going through. But it seemed to me, at least, the types of questions Tamron Hall and Matt Lauer were asking were questions that needed to be asked. Did he know the building wasn't zoned for residential use? Why wasn't he in the building that night? Some things that investigators are likely asking, too.
I mean, they were asking questions that journalists would normally ask in after a fire if they're talking to someone who has knowledge about what was going on. So I have no problem with their questions and what they were probing. I understand the anguish. He was, you know, you could see how visibly upset he was, and he had a message that he wanted to get out. This is what happens when journalists are interviewing people who aren't normally in front of the camera, who aren't normally answering these types of questions from journalists or any kind of investigators. And you have this. I mean, police and other investigators see this all the time. Very seldom does this kind of anguish actually wind up on camera, because we edit a lot of it out. But live television provides the opportunity to see this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And I do think that somebody should have advised him, listening to anybody, not to do this interview. I mean, I think it'd be hard for anybody to say that he didn't mean everything he said. I think he probably did feel like he'd gone from being a hero to the artist community in Oakland and the Bay Area to somebody who may have been responsible for their deaths. And so that's a tough thing. And he couldn't answer those questions if he was smart in terms of his legal liability. So I just kind of wish that he hadn't been put in that situation.
No, I agree with you. I think this is one of those instances where you want to get some sort of advice, you want to get some sort of counseling before you go on live national television, and you should know going in that those questions are going to come up, mm-hmm. and have a response for those questions in a way that maybe doesn't incriminate yourself from a legal perspective, but can also present the message that you hope to get out to the public and to the families that were hurt by this.
I think there was a bigger aspect to this story, a trend aspect to the story that we shouldn't leave out.
Absolutely.
Even though the anguish there was obvious, and I think you pointed
it out
on the links blog.
I wanted to, ask about this very specifically, because people have been covering this investigation, and that becomes the natural storyline. But one of the really interesting ones, and this is something that we have seen with some of our students as they're graduating and moving to the West Coast, to Silicon Valley, or colleagues we've had who've done the same, that there is a real deficiency in affordable housing in the San Francisco and in the Oakland area, which has led to many residences like this ghost ship warehouse that are not zoned for residential use, but it's the only way to begin to provide affordable housing for the people in that area.
I mean, this goes back to things that we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. This is it's a class issue. I mean, people want to move to these areas because they provide not only lifestyle but also the sort of jobs that they want. I mean, this area has been known for decades, mm-hmm. as a place for artists and musicians and those who want to sort of move into that area to go. The problem is it's also known for tech, and it's known for startups, and there's a different economic level between the two. So, and what you're seeing is that tech is winning out in terms of the high cost of rent there, the high cost to live there. That's where the jobs are, but then these people want those things, but they also move there because they want that kind of culture. And there's a difference in economics in the culture that creates these sort of artists
communities.
Right.
And the tech people who are making all the money.
And while I suspect that this example is most stark in the Bay Area, I can't believe this is the only place in the United States where this is going on.
No, it's happening in New York as well. I mean, we have an article on Link Blog that talks about the different how the high rents are in New York as well as on the West Coast.
And I wonder in other artist meccas like Miami and maybe in Seattle, mm-hmm. and some other places, this could be the next story that journalists probably are, they certainly should be looking into.
Well, to me, one of the issues that we have is that when you start talking about these stories is that it takes an incident like this to actually get to the story about the high cost of housing or the high cost of living in these areas.
Okay. Well, remember last week we mentioned in passing how fake news can have some real implications for real people. I have a couple of examples of things that have come up since our show last week that, frankly, kind of scare the heck out of me. The first is a case coming out of California in which which the police say that they intentionally put out false information, misleading journalists to report a story the way that they wanted it reporting in order to advance their investigation. What exactly happened here? What are some of the details of this case exactly?
Well, as the police describe it, there are rival gangs and there have been a lot of murders in this community as a result. And the police believed that informants from the other gang were targeted to be assassinated by the other gang. And they decided to put out this news release saying that these two gentlemen had been deported basically for violating immigration laws as a way to protect them and their families from this imminent catastrophe. And so they used the fake news release to do that. And of course, I understand why the police did it. And the police apparently don't do this very often. We see a story about this every, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, maybe. It certainly violates journalistic principles, and it could violate that relationship between the press and the police that really needs to be stronger right now. But I don't think the public is going to be on the media's side in this case.
No, I mean, as you stated, I mean, this happens from time to time. And generally when it does, that trust between the press and police goes down. And so then the press is very hesitant to run stories coming from police officers that need to be.
So let me ask you this. As a former cops and courts reporter, mm-hmm. how would you then approach that relationship with that police officer, department, whatever that might be going forward?
Well, whenever I was in one of these situations, I was always probing, asking more questions, asking additional questions. And I did that on every story. And what often happens, and I talk about this a lot when I'm talking to students, is that, you know, the information you get from police, whether it be a email you receive or some sort of press release, you need to consider that a source, or you need to question it. And what I'm wondering here is whether or not the journalists did enough questioning to determine whether or not this was real, or did they just take it at face value?
And I think that becomes an easy thing to do, that we're kind of conditioned to believe whatever's in a police press release. And especially in daily journalism, where you have deadlines going almost by the minute, well, the cop said that, let's go ahead and run with it.
And, you know, they discuss this as an ethical decision on the part of the police department. And I believe that. But my first question when I read the story was, what makes you think that the killers out there were actually going to watch local television or read the local newspapers or whatever, and so that this strategy had to be concocted rather than, you know, coming up with something else? But in fact, they had wiretaps which showed that that's exactly what happened. The folks that were going to go kill these two guys heard it in the media and were talking about it, and then as a result, they didn't go after them or their families. So what would you do if you were the police chief? Would you say, our relationship with the media is so important that we're going to let them know ahead of time what's going on? Somebody in the media in that community would not have gone along, probably rightly, with putting a fake news story out.
Because
what's your option?
No, because it damages their credibility as well. Yeah. And our credibility is not all that great right now anyway. Mm-hmm. So when we're duped into doing things like this, it really hurts not only our credibility with the public, but now you've got to deal with whether or not you can trust the police to give you news and information.
Last week we mentioned in passing a fake news story that was out there about the Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria in Washington, D.C., that, you know, there had been this fake report that Hillary Clinton was running a child trafficking, sex trafficking ring through the basement of that pizzeria. Of course, there wasn't even a basement in the building. Over the weekend, a gunman went into that pizzeria firing off shots because he wanted to self-investigate, his words upon arrest, what was going on there.
It was one of those things where he believed what the information that had been put out there, in particular by outright websites and media, and he decided to just take it upon himself to go and check it out. He goes in with a semi-automatic weapon and fires it into place and say, hey, I'm here to check this out. And he winds up getting arrested. And
with two more weapons in his car.
Yeah.
And the news sources that he said that he admired and was listening to, including InfoWars and Alex Jones is continuing on his talk shows to say, oh, well, this shooting business was just a false flag story. It was really planted by the government or Clinton supporters. So they can even turn a disproved conspiracy into another conspiracy. And this is a guy, Alex Jones, who claims that President-elect Trump called and thanked him after the election, and the campaign hasn't disavowed that. So that's really scary.
I mean, part of the issue here, I mean, not part of the issue, but the issue here is that when you have people who they stay in the echo chamber, they stay in this bubble, they believe these conspiracy theories, they dismiss any kind of credible facts. Now they're starting to act on it, and that puts people in danger, because I mean, he fired those bullets up into the air, they got to come down. Okay, and they could have hit someone, and then we'd be talking about a much different story.
People who died as the result.
Exactly.
And here's the problem. Regardless, people more and more believe this fake news. BuzzFeed came out with a survey. Okay, BuzzFeed survey. It was very well done. If you look at the methodology, it came out this past week. They surveyed 3,000 or so Americans. They gave them three fake news headlines that had been very popular on Facebook, three real news headlines that seemed kind of weird that had also been on Facebook. And what they found is that about 3/4 of Americans thought those fake news headlines were either somewhat or very trustworthy, right? And only 80-some percent of Americans thought the real news headlines were somewhat or very trustworthy.
Okay, well, this next example doesn't have the same level of physical threat, but it does give us more insight into how people interpret what they see and hear. Take a listen to this. CNN's Allison Camerota talking to a group of Trump supporters about claims of widespread voter fraud.
Voting is a privilege in this country, and you need to be legal, not like California, where 3 million illegals voted.
Let's talk about that.
I'm glad I brought that up, Allison.
Me too, Paula. So where are you getting your information?
From the media. Where
what,
else
which
are
media?
We getting? Some of it was CNN, I believe.
And CNN said the 3 million illegal people voted.
Well,
in
it was coming
California?
All across the media. All across. Well, CNN didn't do it. Then they were being smart this time.
Do you think that 3 million illegal people
I
voted?
I believe in California that there were illegals that voted.
How many?
I don't. To tell you the truth, nobody really knows that number.
But do you think 3 dozen or do you think 3 million?
I think there was a good amount because the president told people that they could vote, and it happened in Nashua. We caught some people that they went into Nashua and they said, the president said I can vote. I'm here illegally.
Did you hear President Obama say that illegal people could vote?
Yes, yes. I heard it this morning.
Tell me, where?
You can find it. Google it. You can find it on Facebook.
You, as you sit here today, think that millions of illegal people voted in this country. You believe that there was widespread voting abuse.
I think there was in some states.
In the millions of people?
California allows it. People
they do not allow illegal. You mean voter fraud. California allows.
I believe there is voter fraud.
The moment when Camerota literally smacked her head in disbelief. I'm sorry, that was one for the ages.
And here's what particularly disturbs me about this. The people she was interviewing were former public office holders in New Hampshire. They weren't, quote, low information voters. These were people who should know better, who'd been in the political process for a while, and yet they were saying things that were just patently not true. Even in New Hampshire, the woman who was claiming people in her polling place did this, but in fact, the person who's in charge of polling in that town said nothing like that was reported.
I just have one word for this. Education. We have to do a better job of educating people about how the process works on voting, on media literacy.
Okay. That was going to be my question, which process? Because there are a couple processes here.
You can go across the gamut. I mean, if you're here illegally, mm-hmm. the last thing you want to do is show up on a roll. You're not going to walk into a government facility and say, hey, I'm illegal, I want to vote. Even if the president said that, you wouldn't do it for fear of
deportation.
Exactly. It makes no, it's like they suspend common sense.
By the way, let's don't blame it all on them because, in fact, Business News is the one that started this.
So this video did appear. You could find it through Google. You can find it on Facebook. This is the result of a deceptively edited video that was run by Fox Business Network.
So that takes us back to
the media literacy part of it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, I'm teeing you up there.
No, I understand.
I'm teeing you up.
You know, I understand. Fox is doing this. Everyone else is doing it. But that does not absolve the individual from being able to look at that information and determine whether or not it's true or not true. And that means you need to be educated. You should know that an illegal person in this country is not going to walk into a voting booth and say, hey, I want, or a polling place and say, hey, I want to vote. It doesn't make common sense.
Reporters need to know that too, because the reason that Fox Business News was able to edit that thing and make it sound like President Obama said, go ahead, if you're illegal, you can vote, is because the reporter asked the question stupidly, assuming that people who are in the country illegally could vote if they simply were willing to take the risk.
Well, but that, to me, that's a partisan ploy. I mean, it's a part of the
I think the journalist herself maybe really didn't know any better.
Well,
maybe
the anchors knew better. Well, if that's the case, then we need to do some more.
Right.
More media literacy education needs to be done.
I was going to say, that becomes a failure of just primary and secondary education. I don't know about you, but I had to pass a constitution test in order to graduate from eighth grade and high school and college.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that doesn't even fall on us as journalism educators. That's just basic civics lessons.
Right.
So here's something else that I want to talk about that's coming from CNN. Again, this one, not so good for the cable network. There's a standard in our business. Think of every mic as a live mic. Anytime there's a microphone that's in front of you, there's a chance someone is going to hear what you're saying, be it in a control room or on the air. Well, that's what happened last week when a media blogger named Scott Jones got his hands on a piece of video, a conversation between CNN reporter Suzanne Malvo and her field producer, reporting from the Carrier event in Indianapolis.
So he's landing any minute.
Good.
Well, if I do this, it means he's landed.
Okay.
That means his plane's crashed. No, please.
I like that. Nobody's killed, just injured.
Hey, Brooke, well, we know that.
So on that video, you can see Suzanne Melvo's reaction, eyes as big as saucers. And that's because she couldn't believe that her field producer had said this to you. There's some things you never joke about, that being the death of a president or president-elect in a plane crash.
Yep, that's It doesn't matter. No, it goes back to what you said. If the mic is open, even if the mic isn't open, if there's a mic present, you need to be aware that it could be open, and you need to be careful about what you say. But you're right. When you start talking about anything that could lead to a loss of human life, that's not something you joke about. So, you know.
Agreed. CNN apologized to the Trump campaign and, quote, disciplined the producer. I'd like to know a little bit more about what exactly that discipline was. But I will say one other thing. This, rightly or wrongly, just encourages the narrative that CNN is biased against the Trump campaign and the president-elect. And another thing that kind of signifies for me, and I'm not making excuses, but there's kind of this dirty little secret that journalists, like a lot of other people, kind of have their own code and their own language, and oftentimes they say things behind closed doors with their peers that they wouldn't say otherwise.
There's some gallows humor that
there
goes
is.
On there.
I remember, 25 years ago, going out and covering fires a lot, and reporters talking to each other would refer to victims of fires as crispy critters. That's horrible. Yeah, yeah. That's terrible. Yeah. But it happened. You can't possibly think you could get away with that today. Everybody has a camera. Everybody has a microphone. You can't do it.
Right.
Okay, well, remember when Politico was brand new? No one really knew if there would be an appetite for an entire news product that offered only political news. The idea was so out there that the site's founders, John Harris and Jim VandeHei, left the Washington Post when the paper didn't see a future for it. And the two of them launched Politico in 2007 with venture capital money. Well, they've both since moved on, and now VandeHei has a new venture, Axios. It's going to end up covering the intersection of tech with healthcare, energy, and transportation infrastructure. The goal here, in his words, is to deliver a clean, smart, efficient, and trustworthy experience for the reader. Here's VandeHei talking with Recode's Kara Swisher.
Journalists are writing for journalists. That is the biggest problem right now with media. We're writing for each other, and we're writing for the awards committee. We're not writing for the consumer. People don't want these pieces that we're writing. They're too damn long, they don't have enough voice, and they're not written in the way that they want to consume it in their ecosystem, meaning if it's on a newsletter or if it's in Facebook, Snapchat, it needs to be radically different. Now, it doesn't need to be dumbed down. I think the mistake people are making is they're dumbing down content
like
as they try to
move into social. Like news for millennials, like that they need it in some way.
But they're not. They're not mentally retarded. They know how to. They want to come and they want to. People want to consume information. If you go, sometimes I feel like when people write for millennials, they think they have to make it stupid and because they want to get as much traffic as humanly possible. You don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. There's a huge audience out there that wants smart content. They might want it in a different voice on Snapchat or on Facebook, but that doesn't mean that you have to dumb it down and do all the tricks for clicks that we do to try to generate a hell of a lot of traffic. And I think the combination of how we go about the content and then getting it to them with a hell of a lot more brevity. And I think when you see it, you'll say, it's a pretty clever way of getting it to people in a brief, really consumable way.
You take
way.
Out every other word? What?
Every other word, yes. Exactly.
There's an and in here somewhere.
So what are some of the hallmarks of this product that he's going to be trying to launch next month?
Well, I mean, if he can figure out a way to provide news and information that's not fake, that can reach those audiences in a way that connects with them, then he may have something there. I mean, if he's talking about taking what they did at Politico and sort of branching that out to do more stories that aren't politically connected, then there may be something there. But it's going to be interesting to see because the market is so flooded right now with so many startups and so much content out there. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not he's going to be able to burst through that.
So given that flooded market, one of the things that caught big headlines here is that he is somewhere down the line, perhaps 2 or 3 years from now, looking at the possibility of charging subscription rates in the area of $10,000.
And you think that sounds outrageous, and he seems to have a lot of hubris by naming his company Axios, yeah. which is Greek for worthy or whatever. Okay, so they're worthy. Nothing he's proposing on the face of it is different from things that other people have done. But at Politico, nobody believed that you could support good, sound political journalism by giving it to free to the public, but charging outrageous amounts of money to lobbyists, bureaucrats in Washington, other people who wanted the inside scoop. They were paying thousands and thousands of dollars a year for the privilege.
And Politico Pro has taken on and succeeded. 6 weeks from now, President Obama is out of a job. What's next? Well, if you believe an anonymously sourced article published in Mike, his next move will likely be at the helm of a media startup, focusing on how young people consume digital media. It kind of makes sense, or it could at least, if you think about how he's used social media, how he's kind of been the first ever YouTube president reaching directly to the electorate to get his message out there. But the White House says, no, 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 it's not happening.
Well, I mean, the White House may be saying that, but it may be a way for him to get his message out there, whatever message he wants to craft after his presidency. And he has shown over his 8 years in the White House that he can move from media to media to media. I mean, he's done the YouTube, right. he's been on the small radio startups and that sort of thing. So, it may be something. I'm not sure.
Of course, the White House has to issue kind of the standard denial right now. But the editor-in-chief of Mike, which is a site targeted at millennials, is very close to the White House, has been involved in projects with them before. That doesn't mean they're right, but he said they have multiple sources who say that the president is looking at something like this. And I have to say, why wouldn't he? I mean, if you think about presidents in, days of yore, when they left office, I mean, Ronald Reagan was 78 years old. George Herbert Walker Bush was, I think, 68 years old when he left office. Even W was like 62 when he left office. But then you got people like Jimmy Carter, who was 57, right? Or you had people like Bill Clinton, who were 55. Obama's 55 right now. Mm-hmm. They've got 20, 30 or more years left, and they have had the highest office in the world. They don't want to just walk away from all that and have no impact. And if you look at what Clinton and Carter did, they've done some amazing work, since they've been president. Jimmy Carter worked for Habitat for Humanity. Then he went out and set up his, the Jimmy Carter Center. They've supported monitoring elections around the world. Clinton has done the same thing. I mean, you can argue about the foundation, whether it enriched the Clintons as well, but it's done a lot of good work. Okay. Yeah.
Very quickly before we go, Time magazine named Donald Trump the 2016 Person of the Year today, beating out Hillary Clinton, Beyonce, Simone Biles, Vladimir Putin. Thoughts?
I'm not really surprised.
I don't know that there was a surprise there.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, based on what he's done, yeah, I could see it.
It would only have been a big story if they didn't name him Person of the Year. But watch the video that goes along with it. They're showing all this gold gilded stuff in Trump Tower, and he acts very regal in that video.
Okay, well, that edition of Time hitting newsstands on Friday. That music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about all the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see some previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.